Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, your local connection to the world. Produced on WSCA LP 106.1 FM, Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Amy Antonucci, and I'm happy to introduce our show to you today, December 31st, 2011. Here's what we have coming up for you on this last day of the year. After News You Need to Know, Media Minutes brings us a review of important media stories from 2011. Between the Lines interviews a steering committee member of the Bradley Manning Support Network. Then Hidden Histories discusses Vaclav Havel, Bradley Manning, and Occupy. We then hear a Bioneers episode about the Golden Rule, which we think especially appropriate for a wrap-up of the holiday season. We'll also have music and more, so stay with us. First, for some news.
This is Steve Diamond with News You Need to Know. This week, focusing on how Israelis and the U.S. are starting to get sane, particularly on Iran. But first, these stories. From antiwar.com on December 18th. Little attention has been paid in the past to America's remote control warriors, the pilots of the ever-growing number of drones looming over the skies of many nations, lobbing missiles. But a new Air Force study on the pilots of those drones shows a surprisingly high level of stress among them, with 29% facing burnout from long hours. The report also suggests that the drones haven't depersonalized killing nearly as much as officials had hoped. Lieutenant Colonel Kent McDonald said, quote, "When they're involved with missions, when they're observing people over long periods of time, and then they either kill them or see them killed, it does cause them to rethink aspects of their life, and it can be bothersome." And from Agence France-Presse on December 24th, the CIA has suspended drone missile strikes on gatherings of low-ranking militants in Pakistan due to tensions with that country, according to the LA Times. The newspaper said the undeclared halt in CIA attacks is aimed at reversing a sharp erosion of trust between the two countries. U.S.-Pakistani relations deteriorated last month after a series of U.S. airstrikes killed 24 Pakistani soldiers. Some U.S. officials say many of the airstrikes are counterproductive. They argue that rank-and-file militants are easy to replace and that Pakistani claims of civilian casualties have destabilized the government. That's pretty funny phrasing there. It's implying that the Pakistani government's claims of civilian casualties are destabilizing the Pakistani government. So if they stopped complaining, everything would be fine. And now this rather bizarre story from the BBC on December 29th. The U.S. has confirmed the sale of nearly $30 billion of fighter jets to Saudi Arabia. The U.S. will send 84 F-15 jets and upgrade 70 existing Saudi F-15s. The agreement is just part of a $60 billion arms deal covering 10 to 15 years. The military hardware deal comes at a time when Washington is working to counter the influence of the Saudis' bitter regional rival, Iran. A White House spokesman said the deal would support more than 50,000 American jobs at a time of high unemployment. Never mentioned in such stories as this is the fact illustrated by numerous studies that every $1 billion spent doing anything that actually helps people, like repairing roads or providing health care or education, creates far more jobs than building the tools of death and destruction. But back to the story. The U.S. and Saudi Arabia have long been close military partners. But the timing of this pre-announcement is hardly accidental and represents a robust reminder of American support for a key regional ally, just as Iran is warning that it could disrupt traffic through the Strait of Hormuz if Washington imposes sanctions on Iran's oil exports. Washington is also moving ahead with plans to supply Iraq with nearly $11 billion of arms and training. Iran's western flank, already bristling with weaponry, is being steadily bolstered. In Washington, senior State Department official Andrew Shapiro said it would send, quote, "a strong message to countries in the region that the U.S. is committed to stability in the Gulf and broader Middle East." Quote, "It will enhance Saudi Arabia's ability to deter and defend against external threats to its sovereignty," close quote. As well as the F-15s, the larger $60 billion package includes Apache attack helicopters, Black Hawk helicopters, and a range of missiles, bombs, and delivery systems. Few in Washington seriously object to arming Saudi Arabia, but the Iraq deal has its critics. There are doubts about the Iraqi Prime Minister's commitment to democracy. The story should have noted that, in contrast, there is no doubt that the Saudi government is completely opposed to democracy, so arming them is considered fine. Tensions between the Saudis and the Iranians were heightened after the U.S. accused Iran of plotting to assassinate the Saudi ambassador. Saudi Arabia is central to American policy in the Middle East and is also vital to U.S. energy security, ranking as the third largest source of its imports. So, are the poor, defensive Saudis really being threatened? Here's some quotes from Wikipedia. Quote, "The composition of Iran's air force has changed very little since 1979. Its best fighter plane is probably the MiG-29, which came out in the mid-80s, and they only have a few dozen. Next best, they have some F-14s. The Saudis already have close to 200 F-15s in service." Another Wikipedia quote, "The Saudi Air Force has developed from a largely defensive military force into one with an advanced offensive capability." In other words, they're the ones threatening their neighbors. U.S. intervention has delicately arranged for the Saudis to have fighter planes that are superior to Iran's but inferior to Israel's. Overall military spending by Iran is about $7 billion, one-sixth as much as the Saudis spend. In the entire world, only tiny beleaguered Eritrea spends a greater percentage of its GDP on weapons than Saudi Arabia. And from Antiwar.com and the Washington Times on December 30th. "The chief of Israeli intelligence has rejected the notion that Iran, even if they were nuclear-armed, constituted an existential threat, saying the term is being used too freely." Quote, "If you said a nuclear bomb in Iranian hands was an existential threat, that would mean that we would have to close up shop. That's not the situation," he insisted. Pardo is the latest in a growing line of Israeli intelligence officials who have been making comments unfavorable to the Netanyahu government's pro-war stance. Of course, Iranian nuclear weapons are purely hypothetical, as the IAEA continues to confirm the non-diversion of nuclear material to any non-civilian purpose. And from the Daily Beast on December 28th, "When Defense Secretary Panetta opined earlier this month that an Israeli attack on Iran's nuclear facilities could, quote, consume the Middle East in a confrontation and a conflict that we would regret, the Israelis went ballistic. Israel lodged a formal diplomatic protest. Netanyahu's Minister of Strategic Affairs said that he doubts the U.S.'s willingness to strike Iran. Ya'alan said, quote, there is no credible military action when we hear leaders from the West saying, this is not a real option. The price of military action is too high. But Henry Sokolsky of the Nonproliferation Policy Education Center said, quote, you don't propose and go about doing an oil embargo unless you are serious about taking the next step, which is clearly some form of military action. And finally, from Antiwar.com on December 29th, a new poll released today by Israel Radio is hinting at a potential leftward shift of the nation's politics, though the data is entirely predicated on a theoretical move by news anchor Yair Lapid into party politics. The poll suggests that if Lapid created a party, something he is rumored to be considering, he would instantly have the second largest number of seats in Israel's parliament. Lapid could create a center-left majority, while the current far-right coalition would need to recruit Kadima to continue ruling. Lapid's father led another party into a similar level of popularity in the 2003 elections.
Thanks to Steve Diamond for that news we need to know, here on Making Waves, produced at Portsmouth Community Radio in New Hampshire. Next, we go to Media Minutes for a review of important 2011 media stories.
Welcome to Media Minutes. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
And I'm Megan Tatey.
It's our tradition here at Media Minutes to wrap up the year with a countdown of some of the biggest media stories of 2011. We start with a saga that began in March when AT&T made a surprise $39 billion bid for T-Mobile. AT&T began to use its formidable lobbying power in Washington, spending nearly $12 million in the first half of the year. Approval of the merger seemed inevitable, even as consumer groups and media watchdogs weighed in against the deal, predicting lost jobs and higher prices.
As opposition mounted, a series of events dimmed the merger's once bright prospects. Nonprofit organizations and civil rights groups that had received money from AT&T were thrashed in the blogosphere and advocacy press for endorsing the merger, highlighting just how much weight and money AT&T was throwing around to gain favor with regulators and the public. In August, the Justice Department filed a lawsuit against the merger. In November, the Federal Communications Commission came out against the deal.
And on December 19th, the deal collapsed. This holiday story places some much-needed hope in everyday people's hearts. Sometimes government agencies actually do turn their backs on big power and money and act in the public interest.
In July, the Third Circuit Court of Appeals dealt a decisive blow against would-be media moguls, throwing out FCC rules that would have allowed one company to own a newspaper and a broadcast station in the same market. In what Free Press senior policy counsel Corey Wright called an absolute sweeping victory for the public interest, the court chastised the FCC for failing to consider the impact of the weakened rules on media ownership opportunities for women and people of color.
The FCC is now considering new rules as part of the media ownership review it conducts every 4 years. Wright said that the FCC should consider its mandate to protect the public interest and take into account the overwhelming evidence that media consolidation hurts the quality and quantity of news.
In April, internet activists were dismayed when the House voted to overturn the FCC's net neutrality rules, which the agency approved last December. Fortunes turned this November when the Senate rejected the resolution of disapproval of the FCC's open internet order and voted to uphold the commission's modest net neutrality rules. The vote sent a strong message to internet service providers that want to prioritize content and services on the internet. It left intact the FCC's ruling preventing ISPs from blocking or discriminating against internet users.
The Occupy Wall Street movement has been a source of inspiration to many of the 99%. As nonviolent actions challenging corporate power took place, cell phones, cameras, and Twitter messages documented the targeting of journalists by police. Since September, at least 36 journalists have been arrested while covering Occupy protests in 10 cities. 13 were arrested in just one day in New York City. Some were roughed up, tear-gassed, or pepper-sprayed. More than 40,000 people have signed a Free Press petition protesting the mistreatment of journalists, and hundreds more have called American mayors and urged them to rein in their police and defend freedom of the press.
In November, a hearing took place on a bill in Congress that could legalize internet censorship. The House's Stop Online Piracy Act and its companion in the Senate, the Protect IP Act, were written on behalf of the Motion Picture Association and the Recording Industry Association of America. SOPA would allow copyright owners to charge any websites hosting user-generated content with copyright infringement. No investigation of the charges would be required. Corporations would need only to file a notice, and the websites would be blocked, along with any associated ads. The bill would also allow banks to freeze financial deposits to the accounts of website owners. In a stacked deck, 5 out of 6 witnesses at the House hearing supported the bill. Several members of Congress have come out strongly against SOPA and PIPA, but Representative Lamar Smith, who is the lead sponsor of SOPA, is determined to bring the bill to a vote early in 2012. Meanwhile, the public outcry continues through petitions, letters, and phone calls.
And those are some of the big media stories of 2011. We'll be back next week with the latest news in media. Best wishes for peace and media justice in the new year. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
Thanks to Media Minutes for that 2011 review. You're listening to Making Waves, produced at Portsmouth Community Radio in New Hampshire. Next, we go to Between the Lines for another important update, this time from the Bradley Manning Support Network.
After 18 months in custody, Army Private First Class Bradley Manning made his first public appearance just before Christmas at what's known as an Article 32 pretrial hearing at Fort Meade, Maryland. The hearing is the required next step in the military's legal process before the expected court-martial of the 24-year-old Manning that will likely begin in 6 to 9 months. Private Manning stands accused by the U.S. government of being the source of 260,000 diplomatic government cables and more than 90,000 intelligence reports later distributed to the press by WikiLeaks. Manning, who has been held in solitary confinement under conditions that his attorney and supporters characterize as cruel and degrading, faces 22 charges, including aiding the enemy, which carry a possible 30 years in jail. Manning's lawyer, David Coombs, has based his defense strategy on two main points. One, the leaks did little real damage to U.S. national security. And two, the military's lax security in running Manning's intelligence unit and their failure to notice and take action to address behavior indicating Private Manning was suffering from psychological distress. Your reporter spoke with Rainey Reitman, a steering committee member of the Bradley Manning Support Network. She summarizes what took place at Manning's pretrial hearing and concerns about how the hearing was conducted and the direction of the prosecution's case.
The way the hearing sort of unfolded, the government, the prosecution, was basing its argument line basically around forensic analysis. They collected all these different computers that Bradley Manning had used at different times and then did forensic analysis on them to try and pinpoint data that indicated Manning had accessed documents that later came up on the WikiLeaks website. And the defense took a different tactic. The defense said, we are here not just to discuss what happened or how it happened, but to discuss why it happened and to talk about this larger issue of government transparency. One of the major focal points of the defense's argument is that there have been no negative repercussions to this information being published, and that what is being charged against Bradley Manning is an enormous overreaction, that he should not be facing 150 years in prison, 24-year-old guy, just trying to make this country a better place, for something that, in effect, did not have any negative impact on our soldiers overseas or on our negotiations in world spheres. So that was one of their core arguments. I believe many of the witnesses that were denied were going to speak to that particular issue.
What kind of penalty do the charges that Bradley Manning faces? What is his possible jail sentence if he is convicted for these crimes? And I know the defense is concerned that the harshness of the sentence that he may be liable to get is in part a way to pressure him to cooperate with the prosecution to pursue a prosecution against WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. You want to speak to that, please?
He nailed it on the head. The defense and many of the analysts who've been watching this case believe that the government is pursuing Bradley Manning in this particularly harsh manner because they are hoping to get him to testify against WikiLeaks and Julian Assange and also to make an example of him. The charges altogether, if Manning were to be convicted of all of them and get the highest sentence, would be some 150 years in prison. The death penalty is actually still on the table. The prosecution has stated that they aren't, at this point anyway, going to pursue the death penalty, though it's certainly possible that that's something that could be faced. The defense has asked that most of these charges be dropped, especially egregious ones like aiding the enemy, and that instead they face simple overstepping classification boundaries and something more to the tune of maximum charge, 30 years. And so what we're waiting for now is for the investigating officer to review the information that was reported to him and decide if he's going to recommend that all of those charges go to a court-martial or whether they should be reduced before the court-martial.
Rainey, I wanted to discuss with you the allegation by the defense that there is an epidemic of overclassified U.S. government documents that in some way led somebody like Bradley Manning to release them, thinking that the public has a right to know many of the things that were divulged in the documents that WikiLeaks eventually did release to the public and the press. Tell us a bit about overclassification as an issue here.
Well, this has actually become a huge issue of public controversy. In 2010 alone, there were 77 million documents classified by our government. That's a 40% jump over the prior year. And the number of people with security clearances is around 4.2 million. That's more people than there are in the city of Los Angeles. The classification of documents has become the default in our military culture. There's this idea to constantly hide things away, but many of the things that are being so carefully classified are not only things that won't hurt or endanger our military work overseas, they also are attempts to cover up some very concerning situations that happen. So, for example, one of the leaks that has not come out yet, has yet to be published, but is attributed to Bradley Manning, is the Guarani airstrike, also known as the Granai massacre in which there's an airstrike by U.S. military forces that killed, I think it was a total of about 120 people, 90 school children. And this is along with the video collateral murder, which shows two Reuters journalists getting gunned down by Americans. Some of the things that Manning saw that led him to speak out and to leak documents. So there's this idea that there was no mechanism in place whatsoever that someone like Bradley Manning would have had a way to get that information out other than leaking it, because there's no way to really unclassify documents for somebody like Bradley Manning, who saw something that disturbed his conscience.
That was Rainey Reitman, the steering committee member of the Bradley Manning Support Network. Learn more about the issues in the Bradley Manning case by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, produced at Portsmouth Community Radio in New Hampshire. Next, we bring you Hidden Histories.
Hi, I'm Jack R. Johnson, and this is Hidden Histories.
Standing on the corner.
The weekend of large events, Occupy Wall Street celebrates its four-month anniversary. Bradley Manning goes on trial for allegedly leaking stolen documents to WikiLeaks, and Václav Havel, famous Czech playwright, jailed dissident, and then president of the Czech Republic, died yesterday. Havel, who famously championed transparency and nonviolence in his effort to liberate his country, might have some interesting thoughts on Bradley Manning's trial and the Occupy movement in general. As dissident and prisoner himself, Havel famously wrote that, quote, "None of us, as an individual, can save the world as a whole, but each of us must behave as though it were in his power to do so." He said that people must resist impersonal power, with the only thing at their disposal, their own humanity. Like Occupy Wall Street, in his famous Charter 77, Havel called for a, quote, "anti-political politics to offset the dehumanizing effect of a totalitarian political regime." Bradley Manning, in his own online confession, noted something very similar. He said that he hoped the video that he had released of the U.S. military murdering innocent reporters and civilians would lead to, quote, "worldwide discussion, debates, and reform," unquote. And if not, he said, we're doomed as a species. Quote, "I want people to see the truth, regardless of who they are or which party they belong to, because without information, we cannot make informed decisions as a public." If Václav Havel were living in this country in the last 10 years, he might very well have been sitting where Bradley Manning is sitting, in jail, on trial for his life. Not because Havel was a criminal or treasonous, but just the opposite. He, too, was a man of conscience. This is Jack R. Johnson for Hidden Histories.
If they shoot me down, to shut me down, who'll take my place? If they bring an army into this town, who'll take my place? If they rule this land and silence me, when I'm laid out with injury, when my words won't matter anymore, who will take my place? Revolution, you are not my own. Are flowers painted on these stones? Ooh, take my place. When the silence of oppression dies, overheard beyond the battle cries, are the words of final compromise. Take my place. when this world's an empty creaking floor. Ooh, we'll take my place. If they rule this land and silence me, when I'm played out with injury, when my words won't matter anymore.
We just heard the Ducks singing, "Who Will Take My Place?" You're listening to Making Waves, produced at Portsmouth Community Radio in New Hampshire. Next, we bring you a Bioneers episode about the Golden Rule. We feel this is a great way to wrap up the holiday season, as well as an inspiring way to look ahead to the coming year.
Welcome to the Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
There is an environmental movement, and there is a social justice movement. If they could truly become one movement, the transformation would be unimaginable. When a black child in Oakland winces at the thought of an ancient tree being cut down in Northern California, and when an ex-longer in Northern California winces at the thought of a black teenager in Oakland being cut down on those streets, then we'll know that day has arrived.
It's all alive. It's all connected. It's all intelligent. It's all relatives.
We stand at the threshold of a historic opportunity in the human experiment to reimagine how to live on Earth and with each other in a way that honors the web of life. It's a revolution from the heart of nature and the human heart. As the basic life support systems of planet Earth plunge into dangerous decline, in this series, Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature, we celebrate social and scientific innovators with breakthrough solutions guided by how nature does it. The Bioneers, combining social innovation, leading-edge science, and indigenous and traditional knowledge, creating a future environment of hope. One of the most profound instructions for living on the planet Earth should be familiar to any thoughtful houseguest. Leave things better off than you find them. As biomimic Janine Benyus likes to say, the best way to take care of future generations is to take care of the place that will take care of them. But could it be that the best way to preserve the place for our children and the ecosystems they will depend on is to respect the dignity of people today? Author Paul Hawken has been tracking the rapid proliferation of not-for-profit, non-governmental helping organizations around the world. He's found that at their core, they share some simple, ancient, and powerfully uniting principles. Join us for the next half hour as we explore the Golden Rule, restoring the Earth by restoring human dignity, with Paul Hawken. My name is Neil Harvey. I'll be your host. Welcome to the Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature.
In my talk here 2 years ago, I suggested that the social justice, environmental movements, and indigenous movements were intertwining and morphing and became or becoming the largest movement in the history of the world. That they were, in essence, humanity's immune response to political corruption, economic disease, and ecological degradation.
Paul Hawken is the brilliant author of such landmark books as Blessed Unrest and The Ecology of Commerce. As a social entrepreneur, he's launched several environmentally focused companies. He spoke at a recent Bioneers conference.
I've spent, since that speech 2 years ago, 2 years researching and writing, trying to trace back where did we come from, not just as people, but where did this movement come from? It is growing very fast now. It is very large now, but it actually has very, very deep and ancient roots. What we know, I think, is that over the years, the ingenuity, the genius, the imagination of the organizations, of social entrepreneurs, of engineers, of designers, of individuals has created a powerful arsenal of tools to address what ails us in the world. And the financial and technical means are in place to restore the needs of the biosphere and society. There's no question about that. Poverty, hunger, and preventable childhood diseases can be eliminated within a generation. Energy use can be reduced by 90% in developed countries, and the remaining 10% can be substituted with renewable energy. The educational gaps in opportunity that exist, particularly in this country, can be closed within 10 years. Dignified living wage jobs can be provided for every single man and woman in the world who wants one. The toxins and poisons that permeate our daily lives can be eliminated through green chemistry. Biological agriculture can increase yields, reduce and eliminate pesticides and poisons and other inputs, and save family farms. Green, safe, livable cities are at the fingertips of people, designers, architects, and planners. Inexpensive water technologies can decrease usage and improve the purity of water so that every single person on Earth has clean drinking water. Now, what's going on, though? We can do all that. If this movement is so big, right? Something missing. It has been said by many that we cannot save this planet unless there's a widespread spiritual or religious awakening. Mm-hmm. When I've heard that in the past, I have sort of buckled and sort of stiffened. Not because I didn't think it would be a good idea, but because I thought, well, yeah, but we have work to do. Things are going so fast. We can't depend on such a thing arising, you know. But in my research for the book, I have come to think about this in a different way. And my question to you is, would we recognize a spiritual awakening in this world if we saw one? Or let me put it another question to you. What if an awakening was already deeply in place and we don't see it? In other words, it's here.
Might an awakening actually be underway? Some movement without a name, humanity's immune response to the unprecedented challenges we face, is it here? Natural Capital, a nonprofit institute founded by Paul Hawken, counts how many organizations dedicate themselves to restoring the earth and healing human culture. Audubon Society Bird Lovers, a Cree Indian project opposing toxic waste, you name it. The count has reached 1 million groups worldwide, involving 10 million people. But it's not the first time such an immune system-like movement has kicked in. More than 2,000 years ago, in an era not unlike our own, the emergence of agricultural states introduced an unprecedented scale of displacement, slavery, war, and environmental disruption. Hawken points out that these violent upheavals resulted in a great moral ferment. He says the resulting precepts remain with us to this day and unconsciously drive this movement without a name. Again, Paul Hawken.
In her work, which I recommend, The Great Transformation by Karen Armstrong, she details the origins of our religious traditions during what's called the Axial Age, a period between 200 and 900 BCE. This is a time when much of the world turned away from violence and cruelty and barbarity. There was such an upwelling of philosophy and insight, intellect from that period, is carried forth in the work of Socrates and Sophocles, right? In Lao Tzu, Confucius, Mencius, the Buddha, right? Rabbi Hillel, and others. But rather than religious institutions, these teachers were bringing forth social movements that addressed human suffering, right? Later, they were called Confucianism, Hinduism, Buddhism, Taoism, monotheistic Judaism, democracy, right? And philosophical rationalism. But in their origin, these were not theocratic systems. They did not require belief. They required practice, action. They were not trying to create doctrinaire institutions, but a compassionate society. They asked their students to question and challenge everything, to never take anything on faith. They urged people to change how they acted in the world, and all of them relied on one common principle, the golden rule. Do not ever, ever do anything to anything or anyone that you would not have done to yourself, right? Rabbi Hillel said, don't do anything to your neighbor you wouldn't do to yourself, right? That is the Torah. Read it. All the rest is commentary. That's it, if you get that, right? These were not theocratic systems. They didn't require belief. They required a change in behavior, right? Armstrong, again, this is a quote. The axial sages were not interested in providing their disciples with a little edifying uplift after which they could return with renewed vigor to their self-centered lives. Their objective was to create an entirely different kind of human being. Sages insisted that people abandon their egotism and greed, their violence and unkindness. And not only was it wrong to kill another human being, you must not even speak a hostile word about or towards that person, not even make an irritable gesture. Further, you cannot confine your benevolence to your own people. Your concern must somehow extend to the entire world. If people behaved with kindness and generosity to others, they could save the world. Well, this is what they were teaching, right? But no one at that time said, hey, we're in the midst of a spiritual awakening, right? It was a very difficult time, far from perfect. It was riddled with betrayals and jealousies and misunderstandings. The axial sages lived in a time of war. Their goal was to understand the source of violence, not to combat it. Their practices guided the mind with very simple precepts that slowly and gradually changed the heart. Enlightenment was not the goal. Kindness, action, and compassion were. These teachings, are the source of charity in the world. They are the source of NGOs, of philanthropy, of institutes, of collectives, of alliances, of faith-based organizations. These teachings are the source of what it is that we are creating to this day, you know. And what I'm suggesting is that unknowingly, perhaps, this movement is tipping its hat and returning the favor to the axial age and is collectively forming the basis of a spiritual awakening. But this is a very different awakening. It is accompanied by an exquisite understanding of biology, ecology, physiology, quantum physics, cosmology, and very, and most importantly, unlike the massive failing of the actual age, the feminine is now seen as sacred and holy, right? And it recognizes that the wisdom of indigenous people from all over the world, from Africa to Nunavut, people who didn't fall asleep and require a great awakening, who didn't try to globalize the earth or conquer others, are our sisters and brothers in this movement. I have friends who, if they hear this speech, and they may be here today, will vigorously protest these suggestions, pointing out that NGOs are small-minded, they're turf wars, there's competition, they're selfish, some of the leaders, or whatever, okay. But this is not a question of whether the human condition permeates this movement. It most certainly does. Clay feet march in every single protest that I've been in, because I've been in the protests, okay? But it is a question, surely, of whether the underlying values of this movement are permeating global society, and I say they are, right? And this question is about intent. What is the intention of this movement? If you look at the values, the missions, the goals, the core principles that inform it. And then you parse that language, and underneath it, albeit unstated, is always the golden rule. And second is life is sacred. Sacredness of all life, whether it's a child or a creature or a culture, right? This is this movement. This is this awakening.
Could Western civilization's oldest ethical instructions have relevance to our newest environmental problems? Could restoring respect for human beings be the key to restoring the health of the planet? When we return, Paul Hawken explores the biology of compassion. This is the Golden Rule, restoring the earth by restoring human dignity. I'm Neil Harvey. You're listening to The Bioneers, Revolution from the Heart of Nature. If human beings were truly respected, could the earth be restored? Today in the San Francisco Bay Area, salmon have all but vanished, victims of dams, depleted rivers, chemical pollution, and other insults. But what if over the past two centuries, human dignity, culture, health, and livelihoods had been respected? What if settlers hadn't decimated Native Americans whose cultures co-evolved consciously and successfully with salmon for thousands of years? What if we didn't let dam builders flood villages and native sacred sites? What if export agribusinesses couldn't siphon off huge quantities of river water and expose migrant workers to pesticides, which then leach into what water remains and contaminate the bay? If the Golden Rule prevailed, would the salmon prevail? It's the kind of question posed by Paul Hawkins' unnamed movement of millions. Truly addressing that question could have profound effects. Again, Paul Hawken.
It is the first time a movement understands that honoring the web of life is integral to compassion and is integral to it as addressing poverty and violence and oppression. There are still two movements, though. There is an environmental movement and there is a social justice movement. They are definitely coming closer. Every Bioneers is about furthering that, but they are not one yet. If they could truly become one movement, the transformation possible would be unimaginable. When a black child in Oakland winces at the thought of an ancient tree being cut down in Northern California, and when an ex-longer in Northern California winces at the thought of a black teenager in Oakland being cut down on those streets, then we'll know that day has arrived. The thing about the environmental movement is it seems to have the upper leg because the house is burning down. It is, literally, right? So it's very easy for the environmental movement to turn to social justice and say, yeah, I know everything, that's really important, but gosh, the house is burning down. Come, you should come on our bus and join us, right? And I think that it's upside down and backwards. Global warming is injustice. It's a type of colonialism. I think that if the talent, the imagination, the ideas, the brilliance that is in this room, that is represented elsewhere in so many ways, is going to become effective in time, we have to slow down and stop and change the bus. I think the environmental movement has to get on the social justice bus.
Paul Hawken says that global warming and by extension fossil fuels burning is injustice. So would our fossil fuel culture be possible if we didn't callously disregard human health and culture? What if we forbade coal mining simply because it fouls Appalachian drinking water, and forbade crude oil extraction from Amazonian rainforests and Arctic slopes because it destroys indigenous cultures, refineries because their pollution doesn't belong in our bodies, and the use of fossil fuels because global warming will deprive Inuit people of their livelihoods? What if Rachel Carson was right, that pesticides are a human rights issue? What if the environment is actually our body, our language, our livelihood, our brother and sister? Would we act more urgently? Paul Hawken takes us to the civil rights movement for an answer.
When Martin Luther King was drafted into being the leader of the Montgomery boycott 51 years ago, it was 5 days after Rosa Parks got on the bus. And what is often not told is that when the door opened that night on December 1st, the bus driver was James Blake. Now, James Blake had physically manhandled Rosa Parks and wrestled and threw her down to the ground 12 years before, and she had never seen that bus driver again. And when that door opened up, her heart dropped. She was absolutely panic-stricken, and she got on the bus. Right? Amazing act of courage on her part, right? And 5 days later, when she was arraigned, they elected Martin Luther King to be head of the Montgomery Improvement Association, and he had 15, 20 minutes to give a speech, and the first thing he said, it's one of his finest speeches to this day, but was a simple phrase, and he said, "There comes a time." And if he were alive today, he would say it again, "There comes a time." There comes a time for all that is harmful to leave. There are 1 million organizations in this world, 1 million escorts, and they are here to transform the nightmares of empire and the disgrace of war upon the people and places on this earth. You know, we are the transgressors and we are the forgivers. We means all of us, everyone. There can be no green movement unless there's a black, brown, and copper-colored movement. I said this is immune system. Well, immune systems fail, too. This movement most certainly can fail. And what stands before us, I think, is a gift of self-perception, the gift of seeing who we really are. Who am I? I mean, we will either come together as one globalized people or we will disappear as a civilization.
Will we disappear as a civilization indeed? New science offers some hints. According to Hawken, pioneering research has suggested that the brain is actually an evolutionary outgrowth of the immune system. And for us humans, that quadrillion-cell system thrives on cooperation and compassion. Studies show that volunteering and having strong social networks help people live longer and healthier lives. Keep thy brother and sister, love thy neighbor, do justly unto others. These old tenets appear rooted in biology. For Paul Hawken, they make us who we are.
Our minds were made to defend us, born of an immune system that brought us to this stage in development and evolution. We are so surfeited with the metaphors of war, such that when we hear the word defense, we think attack. But the defense of the world can only be accomplished by cooperation and compassion. Science now knows that every child, while still in diapers, exhibits altruistic behavior. It's hardwired. It's in our genes. Concern for the well-being of others is something we are born with. When we become human by helping and working with others, and buried in those 1 quadrillion cells, in those lymphocytes, in those genes, literally, is faith and love. There is such a fierceness here. There is no explanation for the raw courage and the heart seen over and again in the people who march, speak, create, resist, and build. It is the fierceness of what it means to know that we are human and want to survive. To witness the breakdown worldwide in civility, into camps, into ideologies, into meaningless wars, to watch the accelerating breakdown of our environmental systems is harrowing and dispiriting. And what it takes to arrest our descent into chaos is one person after another remembering who they are, where they are, and joining together to save and restore life on Earth. It is such an honor and privilege to speak to you, for which I offer my bow and my deepest respect. Thank you all very much.
Paul Hawken. In the unnamed movement Paul Hawken has uncovered, millions are remembering who we are, remembering where we are, remembering to do unto others only what we would have others do unto us, and remembering that all life is sacred. Science is saying that we are hardwired for compassion. It appears that as I respect your rights, care for you, and work for justice for all, what was missing will be restored. Love will be restored, and so will be restored the earth. The Golden Rule, restoring the earth by restoring human dignity.
You're listening to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice, produced at Portsmouth Community Radio in New Hampshire. Many thanks to Bioneers for that fantastic episode on The Golden Rule. And now let's hear from Holly Neer with Planet Called Home.
Can you call on your imagination as if telling a myth to a child? Put in the fantastical, wonderful, magical, add the romantic, the brave and the wild. Once upon a time there was a power so great that no one could know name. People try to claim it and rule with it, always such arrogance, and it in shame. Thousands of years would pass in a moment, hundreds of cultures would come and go, each generation with a glorious calling, even when they were too busy to know. And then one day, after 2 millennia,
Thanks for listening to Making Waves, Independent Voices for Peace and Justice. The Making Waves crew is Amy Antonucci, Steve Capron, Steve Diamond, Joanne Paradise, and Damon Thomas. We welcome and need your participation too. Please email us at nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com to get involved. Our theme music is by New Hampshire women's drum group Tabalat, and our ending music is Avalon by Amethystium. You can live stream our show if you are not in range of the station by going to www.portsmithcommunityradio.org. Remember that WSCA is your community radio station and needs your support to remain on the air. Go to www.portsmithcommunityradio.org to join and learn more. Ongoing technical improvements for Making Waves also need your help. Go to our website to find out how, www.nhmakingwaves.org. Tune in next Saturday for our next Making Waves program. We leave you with this quote by Vaclav Havel. None of us know all the potentialities that slumber in the spirit of the population, or all the ways in which that population can surprise us when there is the right interplay of events. We at Making Waves wish you a happy new year, filled with joy and with beautiful agitation for peace and social justice.